5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Lift off of the Falcon 9.
Hi, I'm Mark Boucher. Welcome to the first episode of our annual summer season special. We've just completed season 4, and season 5 is currently scheduled to start on September 27th. Between now and then, we'll be featuring weekly interviews or presentations from other content creators. Today we have a Future in Space Operations presentation from April of this year. The presenter is Mike Lindsay, CTO of Astroscale, who discusses the need for satellite life extension services, active debris removal, their technology, and offerings. We offer this presentation now as Astroscale's ELSA-D mission successfully demonstrated repeated magnetic capture of a client satellite last week. In his presentation, Mike states, "Space development demands sustainability." This has never been more true. Space debris is and has been a problem since the early days of the space age. While most space actors are taking sustainability into account, the issue of legacy debris is a problem still without a cost-effective solution. Companies like Astroscale are trying to make the business case by offering innovative solutions. They aren't offering to clean up legacy debris, but what they are attempting is a good first step. As new ideas, technologies, and importantly, business solutions come into existence, we can only hope that all space debris, legacy and new, can be safely removed. Listen in.
All right, thank you. Just a quick disclaimer, I was a bit sick last week, and I'm maybe still recovering, so if I take breaks to mute, just grab a sip of tea or to help my voice. So yeah, thank you all for making the accommodation, change the time here, giving me the opportunity to speak to you all. My name is Mike Lindsay. I'm the CTO for Astroscale. I'm currently based in Tokyo. I've lived here just over a year. I moved here February of 2020, and very interesting time to move overseas. It's been quite a year for all of us, I imagine. To Astroscale, I was part of OneWeb. I was there since day one, so I helped design the constellation, the mission operations of the OneWeb system. I was involved with a lot of the system design, system engineering, mission operations, and then got heavily involved in the spectrum policy, actually, as well as the space debris policy. And was became quite passionate about how OneWeb approaches orbital responsibility and helped the company pursue a solution actually I mentioned today for how to prepare the satellites that fail in orbit for eventual removal by a third party. That was a big part of my role at OneWeb. Which kind of naturally led me to pursue kind of going all in on orbital sustainability and joining Astroscale, which has the mission of orbital sustainability. Previous to OneWeb, I was at NASA Ames Research Center for 5 years, working on a variety of mission concepts, kind of doing mission design, system engineering, and then right before I left, I was doing mission operations on the Lunar Atmosphere Dust Environment Explorer, or LADEE. So that was a really, really cool mission to work on before parting ways there. Today I'm going to be talking about our current mission that is in space right now, ELSA-D. And so I'll walk through the mission and talk about why we're pursuing this and how it pertains to our other services, and then in particular active debris removal, as we see kind of as a significant challenge but very important mission to pursue. So I believe the slides, everyone should have the slides, so I believe I can just speak to the slide numbers there. So if you're on slide 1, you can advance to slide 2. And let me just do a check there. Is that a good way to move forward?
Everyone's with yeah, me. That's exactly right. Try and mention the slide number every time you change it.
You got it. Thank you. Okay. So this slide is a bit about philosophy, which I don't really need to cover, but it's, you know, something a lot of, I'm sure all of us are passionate about. The fact that we understand that space development in the future demands sustainability to go with that hand in hand. And, you know, something I believe in strongly is that to sort of enter this next phase of human evolution or society, you know, even as a made-up concept, to kind of get there, I think we need to have our development be completely sustainable. So not exploiting resources or polluting or depleting what we have, and just sort of more of a closed system. Here in Japan, they kind of consider this sort of what they call Society 5.0, this kind of next stage. And I guess specifically Society 5.0 wasn't targeted at space exploration and utilization. It wasn't necessarily in mind. But if you look at the state of the space industry, we all understand how strongly sustainability and Earth and space are intertwined. Key climate science is done with assets in space and looking at agricultural resources and emissions monitoring, and access to space and safe space operations is key. Key to those applications. And then, you know, if we look beyond Earth orbit, when you think about, settling other planets, depending on how you feel about that, we really can't move on to doing that without figuring out how to be sustainable. So again, you know, sustainability in Earth and space are strongly related here. And, resource exploitation, it really has to be no longer a part of technological advancement. And so what we focus on space should be geared towards and targeting renewables, resilience, remediation of existing debris, and all these technologies that are important for sustainability are trailing considerably behind the development. Just looking at these graphics at the bottom, which aren't necessarily, too quantitative in their depictions, but, just to show that, we're launching significantly more spacecraft, we're utilizing space more heavily, depending upon it, more frequently. And that's all development. But the sustainability aspect is trailing. It needs more investment. So if we go to slide 3, this is what Astroscale views as the technologies and the approaches that can be pursued to improve the current situation. So the first aspect, of course, is better space situational awareness. So just better understanding the risks of the environment, measuring, understanding, scoping out the problem. It's obviously a key first step in planning a way forward, is to understand the problem. And then there's active debris removal. In the most direct definition is removing large pieces of debris. But the idea is that we mitigate the risk of future events that create additional debris, recognizing that one of the most substantial threats to safety of operations is the debris that is too small to track from the ground, but large enough to pose a significant threat to on-orbit assets. The source of those small pieces of debris are large pieces of debris. So we need to focus on getting large pieces of debris before get them out of orbit before they become more of a problem. So that's kind of looking backwards in time, how do we address the problems that have existed in the past? But then looking forward, we need to start planning for end of life deorbit. So this is the notion of preparing future satellites or preparing satellites to be launched in such a way that they can be removed at the end of their life in a safe and predictable way. So whether that's putting a docking interface on or optical fiducials or just, you know, at the bare minimum, keeping in mind in your design of the spacecraft and operations that maybe it would be advantageous or safe or sustainable to dock with or grapple that satellite in the future. That's sort of the philosophy that we are advocating for. And then beyond that is looking at the ability to service satellites, so extend the lifetime, repurpose, and maybe someday recycle satellites that are aging. So we're making better use of the resources and the mass that is already in orbit. And so that's where the Astroscale is really coming in here. That's our mission, is to secure safe and sustainable development of space for the benefit of future generations. So really looking at the long term, investing in these long term solutions that will help the environment beyond just the applications today. And we're founded in 2013. We actually have close to 200 employees now, across 5 offices: Japan, United Kingdom, U.S., Israel, Singapore. And it's an extremely passionate team. Everyone's very driven by the mission here, very inspired. And we've been fortunate to find others who are – oh, I'm sorry. This is slide 4. I'm on slide 4. And we've been fortunate to raise $191 million in capital so far in support of this mission. So we're very grateful to get that that support as we pursue this mission.
Excuse me, Mike?
Yes.
Yeah, Mike, this is Dan. That's really impressive that you've managed to raise so much capital to do this. But a question that I always have about debris mitigation, I'm really curious about the business plan, and maybe you're going to say more about this, but specifically, who pays for it? Is this the people who launch the satellites that will turn into debris? Is it people who are scared about having their satellite get hit by debris? Is it insurance companies? How do you foresee that?
Yeah, thank you for that question. It's really the key question for a business aspect. And I'll say there's folks at the company who are better at answering that question than I am. Some of us like to say, if no one pays for it, then everyone pays for it. So the solution to who pays for debris is kind of, still open-ended to a certain extent, but who owns the debris is the launching state, owning state, and not necessarily the private company. So some of the large debris objects there are owned by governments. And, Japan is, I think, we can kind of consider them to be a first mover in this regard, in that they have commissioned us last year. We won a contract to launch, build the ADRAS-J mission, which is the first mission of its kind to go up and inspect a spent upper stage, so a large rocket body that Japan launched many years ago. And so this is a first mission to go up and assess the state of the object. And it's really a precursor mission to a possible follow-on to actually go up, grapple, capture, and remove this object. So that is one example of a state that is, taking responsibility and then funding technology developments and eventual missions to clean up debris. And we've also seen recently ESA is funding through the ADRIOS mission to remove a piece of debris, I believe, Clear Space. and some other partners won that mission. That's a, I think it was 100 million euros. So that's another, you know, government that's putting some serious money towards this solution. And I'm pretty sure we're going to see others following suit here as this becomes, you know, space becomes, I mean, it's only more and more utilized, and this will be only more of an issue. So I think we'll see more actors come into play here and start investing in these solutions, starting with governments for active debris removal.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and then there's end-of-life services, which is geared towards more commercial operators, and I'll talk more about that as well. Okay, so moving on to slide 5. So this is a look at the various services that we're pursuing. We've spoken mostly about active debris removal, but we have a number of services across a number of orbits, so kind of top-down. Did I say slide 5? Slide 5. So at the top, we have life extension, and this is a service that's primarily targeted for satellites in geosynchronous orbit, satellites that, you know, maybe are at the end of their fuel reserves but have totally total control, complete functionality of the satellite. So, you know, they have an asset that they could generate revenue or have a, you know, longer life, but the problem is they don't have enough fuel to do their station keeping and eventual deorbit burn. So Astroscale would provide a service that we're calling Lexi for life extension to, you know, do something very similar to what's already been demonstrated by MVV-1 mission, which is to sort of attach in a non-invasive way to the client and just provide Delta V, really, station keeping maneuvers as needed to extend the lifetime of that satellite. Next one is in-situ SSA inspection. This is something that we're actually working on right now for JAXA to inspect an upper stage. So we'll rendezvous with the client. We'll take a number of images, assess the tumble rates, assess the structural integrity, you know, make sure it's in one piece and that it's safe to approach. And orbit transfers, honestly, we kind of get that one for free. You know, that's kind of the basis of our services to rendezvous and dock with client and then change its orbit or provide station keeping. So orbit transfers is naturally part of that. But, you know, that type of service is attractive if you're changing orbit of your client or you want to do a salvage operation. If it wasn't deployed, if your satellite wasn't deployed to the right orbit, we can provide a service to correct that. Active debris removal. Oh, is there a question?
Yeah. Are you going to services going to be refuelable by design, and will they be purely chemical, purely electric, or a combination?
Yeah. So the ELSA-D mission and ADRAS-J are going to be chemical only, and the reason is these are, you know, ELSA-D is a demonstration mission. It's kind of a one-off. ADRAS-J is kind of breaking into this the first mission to do in-situ SSA. But as we get closer towards a commercial service, you know, larger scale, we're going to be pursuing, you know, much higher efficiency thrust. So we'll definitely be looking at electrical propulsion, which is the baseline for our life extension satellites, and will be an integral part of our active debris removal as well, because we're you know, aside from a large amount of Delta V, it's just a lot of impulse to apply to a large client, a multi-ton client. So right now it's chemical only. In the future slash now, there'll be both chemical and electrical. Yeah, because we right now, chemical propellant is in kind of mid-thrust capabilities, important for doing the rendezvous and docking maneuvers. So we have ample control authority to do those fine maneuvers at the end of the docking. And then as far as refuelability goes, that's definitely something that's interesting to us. right now because the tankers aren't in orbit, and you know, we're not going to be having refuelability baked into our initial designs, but it's something that we're definitely engaged in and interested in. You know, when you're in the business of providing Delta V, fuel availability is a key resource. So it's definitely something that's on our future roadmap as we move, as, you know, we'll continue to look at that and see how it develops.
I have a follow-up question to something you said there. You talk about moving to larger scales. Is this in terms of the client vehicles you'll target or the sort of the size of the spacecraft which Astroscale will be providing for their services? Could you clarify a little bit more on that? And, you know, if that means higher power spacecraft or if you're still, yeah, what kind of mass ranges you're looking in?
Yeah, so, I mean, it depends on the service line. When we look at active debris removal, for example, kind of the main threat to orbital sustainability are these objects that are 4 tons to 8 tons. So the first objects we're looking at are kind of in the 4-ton regime. You know, we're not targeting 8 tons just yet. So yeah, pretty large clients. Life extension, kind of the same ballpark for GEOs, these multi-ton clients. For end-of-life services, that service arm is really targeted towards some of the large commercial constellations. You know, a lot of the broadband satellites, for example. Those clients are not multiple tons. They're talking typically less than 1,000 kilograms, and then, you know, OneWeb's case, they're 150 kilograms, so it's kind of a range in there. So this is a you know, smaller satellite, both servicer and client.
Okay, thanks. And just a very short follow-up. Do you already have an idea what kind of electric propulsion technology you're planning to utilize?
Yes. Yeah, but I'm not sure if we're kind of settled on the vendors, and actually not sure what I can divulge at this time, but yeah.
Okay. All right, thanks for answering.
Yeah, you bet. Okay. So if we go to slide 6, 6, 7, 8 are just kind of some pictures. Slide 6 is a depiction of ELSA D, which is currently in orbit right now. And I'll actually have a video that I'll ask people to look at in a few slides. So just move on to slide 7. This is, shall I say, an artist's rendition of one approach to docking with and capturing a spent upper stage. I believe this is a kind of a model of the H2A upper stage. So we're targeting the using the payload adapter fitting ring there as a kind of a sort of standard interface, which is present on quite a few debris objects. So that presents a sturdy interface with which we can grapple and control the debris object with our servicer. We'll go to slide 8. It's a look at our life extension in orbit, or LEXI servicer, which is on the left. And in this drawing, it's approaching a client on the right there. And it is also approaching the payload adapter fitting the ring there, which is present on a pretty high proportion of GEO clients. And so we approach it using, it's a little hard to see, but there's these kind of 4 arms that are extending that will grab onto the ring and provide a docking, you know, sorry, it's late here. You know, the docking interface, and we can apply the torques and any of the momentum changes through that interface to the client. And of course, it's capable of doing multiple docking, so it can dock and undock multiple times, and feasibly serve multiple clients as well. with a single spacecraft. All right. Going to slide 9, just kind of a depiction of how Astroscale organizes or kind of views its effort. Tackling orbital debris, I mean, we're mostly talking about technology here, but we already know that there was a question about the business case, who's going to pay for that, and then if it's nation states or commercial operators, does that depend on the policies? Can you even, have your spacecraft dock with another, an asset of another nation state? What precedence is there? So it's a multifaceted problem. It's not just about technology. Our goal is to make this, if we really want sustainability and development to go hand in hand, it has to be, commercially viable and part of an ecosystem where it's not just an expense for operators and states, but it's also seen as an investment in it being mitigation of orbital debris and end-of-life services. So the more that people recognize that this is an investment in a sustainable future and keeping their business operations safer and more sustainable, the more we're going to see buy-in to this philosophy and this technology. So it's, there's a lot of work to be done in building helping others see the business case and kind of taking a long-term view. And then we're doing a lot of work helping regulators, because a lot of this, there's just no existing or supporting policy for these types of activities, which are, I think everyone can kind of see the sustainable value in it, but if the framework doesn't exist, it's hard to know whether or not it's legal. So these are the types of efforts that we're focusing on within our company and across the global organization. So going to slide 10, a little more information about our ELSA-D mission. It's too bad I didn't update the slide, but it was scheduled for March 20th, but there was a slight delay in the ground equipment, so we had to launch on March 22nd. But now we're in space, the spacecraft, we're talking to it. We're currently in sort of the initial phases of commissioning. And this mission is the first, it's really the world's first end-of-life demonstration that proves debris removal technologies end-to-end. And what I mean is the kind of the identification and location of a client, the rendezvous and docking, and then the deorbit of a client that is free-flying. It's kind of the first time that this has been done or will be done. So the spacecraft, it's really two spacecraft that are launched together. And you, on the bottom right, you see them separated in orbit. So we have the servicer, which has the gold MLI and the deployed solar panels. That is the servicer, the ELSA-D spacecraft, as we consider it. It's capable of, advanced maneuvers for rendezvous and docking. It has a docking device, which is kind of depicted on the left there. And then on the right-hand side, you can see free-floating is the client. And the client is launched with a docking plate on it. So it's we call this prepared. And it's a ferromagnetic plate with some optical fiducials on it. And so this helps guide in the servicer for the final rendezvous. And then what it allows is the use of a magnetic capture device. And so when the client is prepared, we can greatly simplify the rendezvous and docking, because we're using a single degree of freedom instead of, our robotic arm. The contact dynamics are favorable, kind of an elastic collision where, the attractive forces kind of help offset some of the errors and just greater error tolerance in general as compared to some other mechanical interfaces. So it's not, you know, if you're looking at fluid transfer, for example, if you want to refuel a spacecraft and use magnetic interface in this sort of configuration, it's a bit different solution, because really what we're trying to do is design something where we can take a hold and tolerate large errors and just have a good contact point with which we can control the client. And the reason why we want to tolerate, have a higher error tolerance is because we need to have a solution that can dock with a client that is no longer controlled. So a client that is tumbling. Okay, so moving on to slide 12. Okay, so I talked about preparing satellites before launch and something that we're demonstrating with Elsa D, and we think it's really important because it predefines an interface that we know serves the purpose. You know, it's safe, it's controlled, because when you do rendezvous and docking, I mean, anytime you have two spacecraft coming together, it's a pretty tricky operation. And so if you understand the interface, that really helps constrain the engineering problem. So if you go to slide 13, this notion is already being adopted by OneWeb. OneWeb is now launching all of its satellites with a ferromagnetic docking plate that was built by Altius Space Machines. We helped out with the fiducial pattern. Go ahead.
Is that standard published?
That is a great question. I know that was the intention. And it should be available, and it'd be disappointing if it was not, but that's a great question. I don't have an exact answer for you. But thank you. I'm going to make note of that. And let's see, just this February, Lockheed Martin announced that their GPS satellites would be upgraded with in-orbit servicing in mind. I don't think there's any further details on what that means in terms of implementation. But this notion that a satellite is not just launched and then forgotten about is something that we'd like to see catch on more. Slide 14, just another point about preparing. So aside from the mechanical interface, to allow for a known docking point, the optical fiducials are very useful in determining the client attitude and guiding in a safe approach. So you understand there's a safe corridor with which you can approach the satellite and not risk running into anything else. So kind of building on that, to going on slide 15. When we look at active debris removal, this is a really kind of a extreme case for on-orbit servicing. It's because there's just so many unknowns about the mission. I lost my cursor here. When you're approaching a client, you know, what is the mass of the client? That's an unknown, because there could be consumables on board that may or may not be remaining or sloshing around. What is the shape of the object? Again, you can have the CAD model available, but knowing exactly how the configuration of solar panels or the antennas and their condition is unknown. Before the mission is launched, you know, and of course the moments of inertia as a result of that, the tumble rate and axes, is the object intact and whole? What does the surface look like? Can you count on enough contrast or reflectivity to guide your sensors? And so that all of these unknowns drive a pretty capable servicer that has to be able to assess and accommodate, changes and unknowns in the client. We talked about the preparation of the docking plate, which helps all that. But, ADR is looking at objects that are not prepared. Most of Space Debris just doesn't have known interfaces to help guide us in. So this is a pretty demanding service that we're looking at developing here. So if you go to slide 16, this is a look at, you know, how are we approaching this problem? Because if you just try to tackle all the unknowns at the same time, it's a significant risk. It's hard to constrain the problem and understand how to get better, essentially. So, kind of our approach is you could look at this as being incremental. So the first thing that we're doing is solving the problem of the dance, which is matching rates with a tumbling client. And so once you zero out the relative motion, docking complexity, I mean, it just gets much easier to dock with and manipulate an object when you have zero relative velocity and rates. It's much safer as well. The next mission we have, we're pursuing the address J mission, which is, you know, we're approaching an unknown object, or sorry, it's a known object, but unknown integrity, but and unknown spin rates. But through this mission, we're eliminating some of those unknowns through inspections. And so this will feed into the spin solution space of the follow-on mission that will do the full-scale ADR. So we're not biting off of, you know, the full ADR mission on step one, which would, you know, have a lot more open parameters. We're kind of eliminating some of the unknowns before we pursue that. So the follow-on would be, yeah, an ADR mission, but it uses previously obtained knowledge. So we're proving out other technologies such as, you know, robotic arm and the control of a client. But moving on past that, we have to be having the full capability to address other unknowns. So, you know, looking at increasing the capability as it pertains to addressing higher tumble rates, more flexibility in robotic arms because we want to address more interfaces on prepared clients, you know, a wider range in masses, and just in intelligent decision making on the robotics to, you know, oh, go ahead.
Is your ADR solution always reentry, or is it spreading the things out that could collide with each other and generate large debris? Are you always aiming to bring them down? Or are you perhaps trying to separate the items, the large items that are most likely to be the sources of new debris?
Yeah, that's a great question. It depends on what the client, I mean, you know, the owner wants, really. I think there's going to be scenarios where, yeah, separating these large objects and making sure that, I mean, for example, two SL-16s in the same orbit, you know, crisscrossing orbits, if we change the altitudes, we're going to lower the risk to the environment significantly. So that is one potential solution, but it's kind of delaying the problem. But, you know, our technology could do either. It's a slightly different solution in terms of the spacecraft capability, because when you do reentry, you know, that's a high thrust kind of mission ending approach. But something that we want to be pursuing long term is more reusability and having the ability for a spacecraft to do multiple missions. So,
right. I was just going to ask. This all looks like one to one type of problem solving. Have you got any one to N? Solutions that you're working as well?
Yeah, so and our UK office is pursuing end of life services, and so the mission we have right now is called ELSA-D. That's D stands for demonstration, and they're pursuing ELSA-M, which stands for multi-client. So the idea is that we have a servicer that does you know, multiples of clients. Because we see that as critical for making this a cost-effective solution, because one-to-one is just, right now, that's kind of the phase we're in for a demonstration. But long-term, it needs to be much more cost-efficient than that. That's,
right on. Thanks.
Yeah, you bet. Okay, so slide 17, really just kind of summary. I mean, overall, what we want to do is balance development and sustainability. And actually, it's kind of an inspiration behind the name of Astroscale, if you think like scales of justice, if you will. So balancing development and sustainability is what we're looking for. And, you know, we have that forward path where we want to prepare clients and provide end-of-life services. But, you know, to really balance out, we need to remediate the debris that exists there. So on-orbit servicing is something that we're pursuing in the future, but we also need to pursue a solution for ADR and getting rid of the debris that presents a risk today. So that's our commitment, is to make ADR part of space development in this decade, you know, make this our regular routine service by the end of the decade. So yeah, slide 18 is just saying thank you. I really appreciate this time. I hope I, you know, want to leave a few minutes for questions here. Yeah, just my contact information. So thank you.
Great. Mike, thank you. And that was an excellent presentation, as I expected. We've got several minutes before our usual quitting time, or this time the unusual quitting time of 11 here in the eastern U.S. And I've got a quick question, then, of course, anybody else has got a question. If you're not giving away, you know, corporate or company secrets or indelicate issues, you mentioned right near the beginning, what, the six countries that are involved in this, something, some number like that. And what was and I don't remember the sort of, what was the motive in a good way for those particular countries to get involved? Did that make any sense?
Yes, it did. And I'm,
Yeah, I don't want you to divulge something that's confidential, of course.
No, I won't. But I'm also aware of the fact that, you know, it's not fully strategic. You know, some of these things just happen. So, for example, one of the first clients we were pursuing and partnering with and working with was OneWeb. So, you know, that they're preparing their satellites. And so that relationship, you know, OneWeb was based in the UK, so it made sense to have more presence in the UK. We already had employees in the UK, but it, you know, kind of strengthened our interest in developing there and being involved with the European, you know, having plugged into the European Union at the time, but UKSA and ESA now. Japan was kind of a natural place for us to be headquartered. You know, there's been a lot of interest in sustainability there. As I mentioned, they're kind of first movers in terms of funding the Address J mission. U.S. was, you know, I think another natural place with the enormous space industry there, and you know, NASA and a lot of the operators coming out of the U.S. as well. Last year we actually acquired our Lexi capabilities from acquiring a company that was previously known as Effective Space Solutions, and they were based in Tel Aviv, Israel. So that's where that office comes from. So, yeah, hope that helps.
Good, thank you. All right, do other folks have questions?
Yeah, I've got one, Mike. I think it's really impressive what you're trying to do with tumbling clients. That's not easy. Doing your first motion orbit around the client, that involves a lot of thrust. I mean, these aren't natural orbits. You're thrusting continuously as you're doing that. And the goal in this is to actually achieve a hard dock between the servicer and the client. And that was a decision that I guess you made, that a hard dock is important. I mean, there have been other ideas whereby you get close to a client and then you fling a net over it or something like that and just capture it. And you don't have to do all these forced motion orbit business. Why did you decide that a hard dock is necessary?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, it is a hard talk, but at the same time, it's I view it slightly differently than the sort of a traditional hard talk as we see it, because it does tolerate a lot more misalignment. So when you're doing that forced motion orbit, and you have the, you know, how you're controlling it with the thrusters, you have a finite impulse, and so you're kind of wavering back and forth. And so having the magnetic interface really helps us tolerate a lot of that error. But yeah, a hard dock is definitely preferred over any sort of tethered approach, such as a harpoon or a net, just because of those dynamics, those couple dynamics of having, a client at the end of a string is pretty risky. I guess I tell people, like, if you have a dog on a leash, you can prevent that dog from getting away from you, but there's nothing you can do to stop that dog from coming back at you. So, you know, if you have that spacecraft at a tether, there's nothing you can do to stop it from coming at the servicer. So having a hard dock was really a safety issue.
Okay, so you're saying that a hard dock is advisable to reduce the risk on the servicer. That's really interesting, and that makes a lot of sense. Okay, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you bet. It's also about confirmation as well, to understand, you know, if you cast a net, it's hard to really get validation or confirmation that you do have it captured.
Right. Okay.
And along those lines, what kind of tumble rate can you accommodate on debris, and what fraction of the high priority debris pieces that you're looking at removal in the 4-ton category fall into that maximum tumble rate constraint?
That's a great question. I mean, there's been quite a few assessments done looking at light curves on geo clients that are tumbling, and those, you know, typically less than 3 degrees per second. I mean, that's extreme, actually, for a geo client. You know, those are typically less than a degree. And so we expect a lot of the clients in NEO to be somewhat similar, but, LCD is the first mission, so it's not looking at multiple degrees per second, I'll say. But looking long term, that's kind of the aim, is to be able to address some of the faster spinning ones. But I guess I predict that there'll be some clients that once they get up there and look at, you know, we could just determine that they're spinning too fast. But it's really hard to know. Right now our best assessments are done looking at the light curves and trying to fit models to that. So it's hard to get kind of a full assessment of what the population is doing out there.
Well, that's a wrap on this episode. Your feedback is very much appreciated. Please use our Twitter channel, @TheEconomySpace, to contact us, or send an email to podcast@spaceq.ca. Help others discover our podcast by writing a review on whichever platform you use. Thank you.